know if you've noticed, it's been a news-heavy year. A lot of news on the old heart this year. A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, you could call it news-heavy.
It was a little bit of news-heavy year. So I've been watching a little bit more cable news than I normally would. And yeah. I the reason why I kind of say that disparagingly is, like, you watch PBS or even watch the network news, you get a better distillation of the day. Mm-hmm. You watch cable news, it's like, oh, somebody stubbed a toe, and it's breaking news. You know, it's a little bit more hypey kind of a thing.
Well, yeah, every cable news does the same thing. Here's a topic. Here's one guy that believes that the sun is yellow. Here's another guy that says the sun is pink, and they're going to yell at each other for a 5-minute segment. We're going to take a commercial break. We're going to switch topics, and we're going to have two other people yell at each other.
Yeah, it's sort of the nature of the beast of having to fill 24 hours. But So the thing that I've noticed, though, and actually I'm glad you brought up that idea of panelists. The thing that I've noticed when I've been watching cable news lately is there is the most human reaction in the world, where they will bring on two undeniable experts, like, okay, this is Skip Bibbles. He's the dean of Harvard Law School, right? And then here is Suzanne Fleshette, and she is the National Institutes of Health senior director, right? They both have 19 PhDs,
yes.
Right? But what happens is, and this is the part that's amazing to me, they'll be like, all right, so Suzanne, we'll start with you. But then you watch Skip Bibbles' face when they pick Suzanne first to talk. And it is the most universally human thing, because it's like, to me, it's like when they're in second grade and somebody gets picked last for team ball or for kickball or for soccer.
Yeah.
Their face is like, oh, like, no matter who they are on these cable news programs, they're like, all right, well, here's Skip Bibbles and here's Suzanne Fleshette.
Yeah.
And then we're going to start off with Suzanne, and on Skip, no matter how many PhDs this guy has, his face goes, you can see it, this tiny little flicker on their face of like, no, I didn't get picked.
Well, number one, there's a lot to unpack there. Number one, I'm choosing Suzanne Fleshette first every time, no matter what.
Can you tell I couldn't think of a second name?
And you went with Bob Newhart's first wife on TV, who was amazing.
In terms of, like, being creative on the spot, I went with Skip Bibbles for the first name, which is
was a
good.
Great
That's
name
a pretty
for
good
a Harvard
name.
Law professor. Absolutely.
And then I got to the second name and I went, nope, I'm out. My brain kindly noped its way out. It's like, nope, I got nothing. Go with Suzanne Fleshette. That's fine.
Oh, she was amazing. She had a voice so husky it could pull a sled.
What a dumb joke. Oh, God.
I liked her. But no, I had a lot of... Were you the kid that was always being picked last out on the... you were a young jock, weren't you?
Kind of. It depends on... Everybody knew not to pick me anywhere near the top half for basketball. I was...
Basketball?
I was terrible at basketball.
Oh.
But anything with throwing, football, baseball, soccer, I could do any of those. Basketball, I am God's gift to bad basketball. I am terrible, even to this day. Like, if anyone's like, hey, let's do a quick 3-on-3 pickup game of basketball, I'm like, I'm going to go sit over here. You're better 2-on-3 without me, because I will actually make the game worse.
You'll actually trip over me at some point, and somebody's going to get hurt. I never understood the rules of basketball. I understood you had to get it in the hoop, which was hard enough. But all this traveling and holding and stuff, dribbling, I couldn't get my head around dribbling. It was a very complicated game for me.
We're learning a lot about young Brad Geiger. Well, hopefully in your adult years, we can get you onto CNN and you'll get picked first, Brad. Oh, and that'll make all the difference.
I cannot wait.
And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his pal, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And the topic I wanted to jump into first on the show today was about luck, Brad.
Ooh.
Because we've heard it from other people, and we probably have said it ourselves, but, oh, didn't they get lucky? Or, boy, yeah. I got lucky. Or, oh, my career worked out because of some key moments of luck and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about luck today in terms of luck versus hard work, or luck being the result of hard work.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think, well, you know, so-and-so, they just got lucky. Skip Bibbles, he's a dean of the law school at Harvard. Skip just got lucky because he was in the right place at the right time to get hired, or whatever it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is... I have my own thoughts on it, but I wanted to start off with thoughts that I thought, Brad, were from Oprah Winfrey, but I did a quick Googling for it before the show. Nope, the quote is not from Oprah Winfrey. It's from Seneca, the Roman philosopher. So I was a little bit off on who the quote is from.
I get those two confused all the time.
It's true. Like, you think of Oprah, you think of Seneca. You think of Seneca, you think of Oprah. It's kind of interchangeable at this point.
So what was the quote?
Well, also, I should mention that the Toyota Seneca is my favorite of the entire line. I think that's one of my favorite Toyotas.
After my love for Suzanne Pleshette, I also have a spot in my heart for Connie Seneca.
Connie Seneca. So the idea here is, and Seneca's quote that Oprah then remade famous is, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity.
Yes.
Right? And so I wanted to talk about this in my own terms, because I think you can actually in life and in your career, your cartooning career, give yourself a better setup so that you are more likely to get lucky in whatever term you want to describe to luck, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you work really hard and consistently hard, if you befriend and learn from like-minded people in your career, and if you learn faster than others, you will get lucky. At some point, quote unquote, luck will happen. Now, keep in mind that luck happened after you worked really hard, befriended and learned from like-minded people, and learned faster than others. But you can sort of increase the potential for luck to happen in your career.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, listen, two things. Number one, I'm super thrilled with today's show. I did not know that we were going to get tips from Dave Kellett on getting lucky. So this is really a show worth...
Louise, instant blushing. I went to instant blushing. I went from happy, confident talking to, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm out.
But also number two, it's also dovetails nicely with something that I always say, and it's taking basically another tilt at the exact same topic. It's a lot easier to be in the right place at the right time when you're always there. When you're always hanging around, when you're always in it, when you're always active, it's a lot easier to be at the right place at the right time.
Is that another Seneca quote, Brad?
that may have been Oprah Winfrey.
I say that again. It's a lot easier to be in the right place at the right time when you're there all the time.
When you're always there. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, Brad, that's a great quote. I love that one.
The longer you stick around in comics, the greater your chances are of being at the right place at the right time. Let's say you only took 6 months. And remember, we talked about this, the 9-month itch, right? The person that sent us an angry email when we co-wrote the How to Make Webcomics book. They'd done it for 9 months and they weren't famous yet. And I always think about that person, because it's like, yeah, well, if you're only around for 9 months, you only have a few chances really of being in the right place at the right time. But if you're around for 5 years, you've got a lot more opportunities.
It's a little bit like, say you're standing in front of a pool table and you send two balls off in different directions, right? What is the likelihood that they're going to hit each other? But if you send 15 balls, and by this, the metaphor here being projects or work that you're putting out or feelers or contacts in the industry, the more that likely they are to crash into each other and produce some, you know, some spark of a moment. Yeah, you're right. The idea that if you're hanging around comics, if you're putting in the work, if you're putting out work, it's more likely that someone, and it doesn't matter who, someone that's the right person will see it at the right time and make something happen from it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I like that a lot. And it has a lot to do with some of the common things that we talk about on the show, perseverance and keeping your head down and doing the work, focusing on the quality.
Yep.
It's a really good reminder to have as all of us have experienced at one time or another. That moment when you're plugging away and it doesn't feel like you're getting anywhere, sometimes along with those taking a good hard look at yourself and seeing what you need to improve, another thing to kind of keep in mind is, well, if this is what you're going to do, you're going to have to stick with it.
Right, right. I love the idea, too, that it is preparation meets opportunity, because frankly, we all know that there are people out there that are truly lucky. They were in the right place at the right time. It literally is a lotto scratch off.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't put in any work. But those people, I want you to separate those out in your mind, because those are the people that accidentally caught lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
The ability for any one of us to replicate that is nigh impossible. And so don't even consider those as part of your sample size for careers that you want to emulate. They were literally a one in a million chance, or, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't want to put anybody on the spot as like, oh, they were clearly lucky, because it might differ. But every one of us has one person in their life for whom the definition of truly lucky, truly undeservedly lucky happened. But you can't take that as your model. The model that you want to put in is somebody like a Steve Martin that worked for decades until it finally clicked, you know? And again, this also goes to Steve Martin's quote, which is, be so good that they can't ignore you anymore, you know, which is an excellent way of saying that when you are prepared for when the opportunity comes, if Steve Martin got an audition or Steve Martin got a chance to try out for something, he had prepared so much and was so good that they were like, well, I don't know about this guy with the pure white hair. That's not really TV ready, but he is so good that we can't ignore him, you know?
And that also speaks to self-improvement and taking a critical eye on your own work and so forth, because Steve Martin did more than just hung out for years on end. He was constantly improving. He was constantly getting better. He was constantly looking at his act, recreating it, you know, making it better. That's a big part of all of this. That's a part of the preparation that has to meet opportunity.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to get that one off my chest, because someone had been using the phrase, you know, oh, they got lucky, or oh, that really clicked for them in a lucky way. Weren't they lucky to get this happening for them? And I was like, no, they weren't. Yes, they were lucky that in this specific moment this thing happened, but they've been putting in the time. They were the 10-year overnight success, in the sense that they'd been putting in a decade and had prepared with thousands of hours of work to get to the next stage.
I've got a theory that says if you look at it would be hard to find a true overnight success, in that if you look at, I'm going to say, the overwhelming majority of overnight successes, you'll find people that have been doing this for 10 years. Nathaniel Payne, the guy that did, is it Strange World or Strange Planet? It's always a four panel with aliens talking about everyday life.
Yeah, Strange Planet. Yeah.
Everybody looked at that guy and it was like, oh my God, where'd this guy come from? You know, he's an overnight success. No, if you look at his history, he's got a long history in comics. He's
Absolutely.
Been doing this for a while. He's been honing his craft, and this is the thing that put him over the top. But there are very few true overnight successes.
Absolutely. And they are so rare and so far between that to include them again as part of your sample size is a bad move. Think about all the people that put in the time, and to the point of the great Toyota Seneca, luck is preparation meeting opportunity.
Absolutely.
All right, Brett. Well, I'm going to jump us into our next topic. This comes in from Mary Rose, and Mary Rose writes, hey, Brad and Dave, I'll call you my comics uncles, but I think we're about the same age. So I guess you're more like the comics cousins, ? But, you know, the cooler cousins whose parents let you ride motorcycles.
Oh, yeah, that's
well,
us.
Speaking of which, Mary Rose, growing up in Southern California, we had a clump of very specific type of Mexican palm tree that grew in our front yard, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say palm tree, you're going to think of the kind with the heavy stalk and then there's a big bulbous thing at the top. This was not that. This was a type of palm tree that was 1,000 spines intertwining each other.
Oh.
And the reason I bring this up is the first time my brother's like, hey, you want to try to ride my motorcycle? I'm like, yeah, I sure do. He's like, all right, we'll do it over here on the grass so that you're not out on a public street. Put this helmet on. I proceeded to ride that motorcycle straight into a 30-year-old tangle of palm trees that stabbed me from every direction with these spines. And my mother was downright ready to kill my brother that he had let me ride his motorcycle right into this palm tree. So, Mary Rose, that's my way of saying that I am not the cooler cousin on a motorcycle. I am terrible on a motorcycle.
There's a word for that. There's a word for that, isn't there? Where when you've got an obstruction in your path and you end up driving right into it, there's a term. That's a thing that happens.
Like a psychological thing, like you're so fixated on the thing that could cause you trouble
that you can't not hit it because you're looking right at it.
Also, there is a weird, a motorcycle has a weird thing in that when you are in crisis, you are leaning back. And so you are then pulling on the acceleration, you know, and
I never thought of that.
Causing even more problems. Anyway, here's Mary Rose's question. We're learning a lot about my inability to play basketball and ride a motorcycle today.
We certainly are. I like this.
All right, Mary Rose's question. Have you ever planned out a brand new project only to have major parts of it change as you actually started to work on it?
Mm-hmm.
Like a big shift in the characters or the format or the layout or the style of writing. I have something I've been writing for a while, but when I try to put it into comic format, it falls apart, and I feel like maybe I need to take a very different approach. This, however, scares me a bit, so now I'm rethinking the writing. Thank you for a truly wonderful and inspiring podcast. This has been such a shit year, but you guys have been consistent bright spot twice a week. Your best of had me crying tears of joy in my car, which is a little bit embarrassing. That is not a little bit embarrassing. That's wonderful, Mary Rose. Thank you for that. That makes our day.
Yeah, thank you so much. We love hearing that you folks like the Comic Lab Best of show. There wasn't a whole lot of comments on it, so I'm glad to hear that somebody liked it, you know?
It's true. Both Brad and I were like, no, I guess nobody liked the Best of show. Yeah. No one commented on it.
Yeah,
no.
I was feeling a little bit sad.
So, Mary Rose, you're our North Star right now. Yes. Thank you for that. We'll just assume you
represent everybody. But that's listen, right. Listen, Mary Rose, what's happening is a very, I'm going to say, so you're like, hey, what's going on? Every time I start working on it, it changes. And you're thinking maybe something's wrong with you or something's up. No, you're experiencing creativity at its fullest. And it's great that things are changing. You want that change. Yes, it's frustrating. Yes, it's very difficult. Sometimes you feel like you're nailing Jell-O to the wall. Your challenge now is to walk a very fine line, because the first thing I'm going to tell you is to, like I've said on the show before, write and write again and write another draft and really try to polish that up before you start working, because certain changes that are going to happen later on are going to be really difficult for you to do once you've started putting your pages into ink or putting them into Final Pixel. So do a couple of drafts. But once you've done that, at some point, just like, you know, good is the opposite of done.
Good is the enemy of perfect.
That's what I'm looking for. Good is the enemy of perfect.
Or perfect is the enemy of good. It's one of those. We
perfect
get the idea,
and enemy
Brad.
are not happy with it. They're on CNN, brought in to yell at each other. Listen, at some point, you got to pull that trigger and you got to go. And yes, things are going to change as you go along. Every outline that I've ever written on, I end up putting little post-it notes, because as I'm doing it, even after I've written it and rewritten it, things occur to me or things come up and it's like, oh yeah, you got to find a way to mention this. You got to do this. Don't forget this guy has a yellow flower coming up and they've got to have a yellow flower on page 6. Things are going to change. Things need to change. You want them to change, because that means you're really immersed in the process. So your best bet is to do as many rewrites as you can before you really start working on it. And then at some point it's like, okay, this is ready to go. And don't get upset. More changes are on the way. It's part of the creative process.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think Mary Rose's mm-hmm. specific problem here is that in taking the writing, she's done the writing part and now is starting to apply it to comics format, you know, maybe laying out the first pages. Mm-hmm. This is the way I was reading her question.
Yeah.
That she's like, okay, it was working on a written page. It's not working so well on a comics page, right? That's one way to read her question. But then I think we can also answer the question like you did, which is there's big shift in the writing style, big shift in the format or layout or the style of writing or the characters. We can also address those. But mm-hmm. I want to talk, Mary Rose, about we have all had projects where the idea is brilliant, but you're trying to find out where it needs to live in the sense that, like, I have had stories, Brad, where I'm like, I can't make a comic out of this. This is a short story. I need to write this. This is a narrative, you know?
Interesting.
And I don't end up doing anything with it. But for whatever reason, I just know that it doesn't work as a comic. You know, it works as a narrative. It doesn't work as a comic.
Yeah.
And then there are things that I've had where ideas that I've had in comics where I'm like, I could write this, but it would work better as a poem. And you've probably seen, Brad, every once in a blue moon, I'll do a poem in the comics.
Yeah. I like
just
those.
What's that?
I like those.
Oh, yeah. But what I'm saying is it is tricky, and it is a moment of consideration to say to yourself, where does this live? How does this live?
Mm-hmm.
when Fred and I were doing Stripped, we could have done that as a series, as in terms of TV shows, like installations of, or we could have done it as a documentary film, or we could have done it as a documentary book. In fact, we talked about that at one point. And we landed on documentary film as being the best way to get one cohesive sitting for taking in the subject matter versus multiple, like 10 episodes, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to say that before we get into the idea of changing, there is a consideration at the beginning of like, where does this live? How will it live? What's the best format for it to live? And so I understand, Mary Rose, if sometimes when you go to put it down on the page, it's tricky. But I also want to warn you that sometimes that's just comics. It just takes a minute to take the idea and start to apply it to the comics page. So I don't want you to be scared off of it. If you saw it in your mind's eye as comics, and then only in the process of applying it does it become hard, that's just comics. It's just hard to create a mix of word and picture that dances, right? And so I don't want the fact that it's hard to scare you off of doing it. Sometimes that just means it's worthwhile doing, even though it's hard.
Yeah.
But now, Brad, I want to talk to her other question, because Mary Rose had said, have you ever had major parts of the story change once you actually started working on it, like a big shift in the characters or the format or the layout or the style of writing, which I think is a different question on Mary Rose's part than the one about it falling apart when she tried to apply it to comics. What do you think about that? Have you ever had something where, let's say, for example, the characters have a big change? I know you had that, where you basically rebooted, right?
Oh, yeah. But not after I already started the story. See, what happens is very often, and it's part of this give and take that we have with our readers, what happens is once you've started a story, a lot of times you're tempted to change the latter parts of the story because of, for example, what readers are saying right now or what you're noticing right now. There's lots of reasons that you might want to change something once you've already started down that pathway. I've been tempted a lot of times to change a story based on any number of those things. My own personal guidance on that is it's got to be a really, really good reason. It's got to be a big reason, because those times that I've dabbled with making smaller changes based on things as they were happening is that I miss a detail or I miss something, and now I've completely tripped myself over things like continuity or motivation or things like that, and that I already had worked out. And then when I changed it, I screwed everything up. So my personal preference is to avoid being tempted to make major changes once I've already started down a storyline. But if you are going to do that, make sure that it's important enough to do, because otherwise you end up tripping yourself up.
Yeah. One idea that I want to introduce here, Mary Rose, is the idea of an implied promise between an author and their audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, you were talking about how have we ever had a format or layout change in the middle of comics? And I think, let's say you get, 40 pages into Watchmen, and suddenly the color palette is very different, or the page layouts are almost a different size, and they don't lay out the same way the previous 40 pages were.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, you are breaking the implied promise between the author and the audience of, this is what you can expect. This is the parameters of the world. This is how this story is going to be told. And so I use that a lot on this show. I know I've talked about in the past how your first 10 or 15, 20, 30 pages promise to the reader what they're going to get. So if you're starting off comedy and then it ends as tragedy, absolutely you can do that. Absolutely that kind of story has been told.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little bit of a bait and switch in that you are promising a hijinks comedy that then turns into, oh my God, three characters have cancer and they all died. How did that happen?
Right.
So it gets... That you have to allow for that. Absolutely. You can change up stories and tones, and the authors can change in the process of writing a story. I'm granting that. I'm just saying the greatest novels and stories in history live up to their implied promise in their first 10, 20, 15 minutes or 15 pages.
I'm so glad to hear you say implied promise, because we had another question that came through that was about change as you're working. And I think it's an implied promise type situation. I'm going to read it to you, Dave, and see what you think. This comes in from Sky. And interestingly enough, I also just realized this, Sky also refers to us as the comics uncles. So
I'll take it.
There's a lot of similarities. As the writer of a long-form series, I'm aware of the route the plot will go and how themes will become more mature as time goes on. And as the story develops. However, at present, I would consider the theme of the comic teen to young adult, but will become darker and have more scenes that will be more likely to get an adult rating on the big screen, violence, horror, etc., increasing as the story progresses. What are your thoughts on a story becoming more mature as the readership does? Is it shooting myself in the foot by ending with a finished product that would be no longer considered teen-friendly, or is it better to keep my writing integrity and letting this tale unfold how it's been envisioned? Thank you all for your great advice week in and week out. Dave, that sounds to me like a implied promise situation. Am I right?
This sure does. Sky, yeah. You've brought in a question that is exactly tail ending to that last question.
Yeah.
So I think that, again, most authors would accept that you have changed as a person as you're writing. The story can change as you're writing. Absolutely. You know, nothing is set in stone. You're not the exact same Brad Geiger 6 years later when you are working on something than when you started it. Mm-hmm. I'm not implying, Sky, that you've suddenly turned into Brad Geiger. I was just using Brad Geiger as an example. But I think you've hit on a specific exception where it can get tricky, and so it's worth talking about.
Yeah.
I think any time you have a piece of work that is at the start, the implied promise is this is for kids, this is for teens, this is for a group of people who we all as a society have said, hey, maybe hold off on certain topics or certain presentations, you know. Then when you suddenly age that up 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 10 years, or more importantly, age up what the age rating would be by any consideration of what an age rating is. Mm-hmm. Then I think you start to get into trouble, Sky. And I think that there's nothing per se wrong with it as long as the entire work would then be marketed as for adults. But you can't then market it for teens if the last 40 pages are undeniably for adults. And obviously, I don't know what this book is or how it presents. But based on your description of it, if it is much more gore and much more horror that, say, a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old wouldn't be appropriate reading it, then don't market the first 40 pages as being, you know, young teen appropriate or tween appropriate, and then suddenly be like, well, now it's NC-17. You know, I'm sorry about that. It's NC-17. I got to change it up. Brad, what are your thoughts? I've talked too much about it.
I can't agree with you more. And I'll be honest with you. When I first saw this question come over through the Comic Lab Patreon page, it was not the first thing that came to mind. I was all team change, you know, change is growth, growth is good. But then when I heard you say implied promise, it completely changed how I thought about this. And you're right. There is an implied promise there. And you do have to kind of follow that through and say, okay, I've started out with this thing. I'm aiming for teens. I can't start with a PG-13 and end up with an R rating, to use movie terms, right? I've got to stay in my lane, right?
Yeah, and I think, Sky, I think most thinking adults would give you a little bit of a pass if you go from, say, upper teens to adults. Like, I think most people be like, all right, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you, I think it gets more dangerous the more dramatic that shift is. You're like, this book is for 8-year-olds. 8-year-olds are going to love it. Whoop, nope, now it's XXX. And you can't be like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is that the bigger the move away from the original implied promise, the bigger the problem. And so, Sky, I think the fact that you are sensing that there might be a problem with that implied promise tells you that it's worth considering as you do that work. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
So, Dave, do you have your Eisner submissions in?
Brad Geiger! I actually don't yet. No, I don't have my Eisner submission in. Do you? Do you have your Eisner submission
in? No, nowhere's near. I'm way late on that. But I do. I just wanted to remind you because I know that they are due on the 15th of March, and that's coming right up.
That is coming right up. I want to ask you, this is separate from talking about the Eisners.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think less work got produced in 2020 in comics than in 2019?
Interesting. Perhaps less work that was backed by publishers, for sure, and maybe less independent work. I'm going to say that overall, that you may find out that there was less work indeed published in comics.
Yeah, I'm almost wondering, in a sort of impossible to quantify but kind of fun to think about, I think you might stand a slightly better chance of getting nominated for an Eisner this year than the average year, because I feel like Marvel and DC must have put out less. Image must have put out less, right?
Well, yeah.
I can't imagine that people were gung-ho in the first 6 months of the year.
There was a good few months where even if they were put out, they weren't getting distributed. so then they would have had to cut back in the subsequent cycles. So yeah, I'll bet there was less stuff put out.
I think there probably was. Anyway, to the point of the Eisners itself, as Brad and I talk about repeatedly, it is worth submitting to the Eisners if you are, for one thing, proud of your work. But it's worth it even for the chance to look over your work for the year. To see what was really a highlight, see what was shining for you. It's a great way to sort of do a self-review and to narrow it down and submit to the Eisners themselves. If you do a quick Googling for Eisner, Jackie Estrada, Eisner submission, you'll get the little one-page sheet that the Eisners put out.
Mm-hmm.
And then for backers of patreon.com/comiclab, I will say that in a recent Pro Tips, we went through an exclusive guideline from Jackie about how and where and who and what to do with your Eisner submission that I think is helpful for people, even like myself, that submit every year. There were a couple of Jackie's points. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense to do it this way and not that way. So do check that out over on the Pro Tips, which is an episode we do every week for Patreon backers at patreon.com/comiclab. And one of the more recent episodes has Jackie Estrada's basically pro tips for submitting to the Eisner.
Yeah, it goes into pretty good detail there. I refer back to that quite a bit, and it's helpful. So, Dave, you wanted to bring up a topic today on the show. Your note here says, it has me a little bit scared. I'm scared I'm heading into a, what do you call those, where all your friends line up and say how you heard them?
Oh, like almost an intervention or a...
Yeah. It says, you want to talk about the dangers of mixing friends and business. Too often you destroy the friendship and the business, I guess.
You started doing the voice of that dad behind you when your kids were going to Russia. What was that guy again?
I guess you don't have to worry because they don't have Wi-Fi in Russia. So I guess you don't have to worry.
They don't have internet in Russia, right? Hey, quick question from the back. Are my kids going to need a jacket for Russia? Is it getting cold at all?
As it turned out, they didn't. It was unseasonably warm when they went to Moscow. Alex was like, I was burning up.
Oh, thanks, humanity, for the last 50 years of global warming. Yeah. That's fantastic. Good job, everybody. So I did want to bring up this topic of working with friends because I was recently thinking about a friendship that got ruined by doing business together, and it got me kind of sad. And I wanted to talk about ways you can protect against the worst thing happening. Because are you going to want to work with friends? Of course.
Yes.
Do I myself work with friends? I have one of my best friends right here, Brad Geiger, sitting doing a podcast every week for the last 4 years. And so, yes, I've done a documentary film for a 4-year project with another dear friend, Fred Schroeder. And so either one of those friendships could have fallen apart with business. So I wanted to give you some possibilities, which is one, really consider if you're doing the project with the friend because they're the best person to do it with, or just because it's convenient. Just they happen to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is worth scanning around your horizon and going, all right, what's the another professional that is a better stand-in than this friend right here? And if you don't happen to have a better stand-in, then yes, absolutely, do the podcast with Brad. But if you can...
You dirty bird.
I don't know where I was going with that. Anyway, what I'm saying, though, is that... friendships, though, are a wonderful way to do art. They're a wonderful way to create art because you know each other. Sometimes on an almost intuitive level, you can see where the other one is going.
Yeah.
But there is a downside, which is sometimes you can destroy not only the business venture, you can destroy the friendship when you do a art project or a business project around art with that friend. So I wanted to give you some bits of advice on how to do an art project with a friend. Number one is you gotta have a conversation. And I know that sounds so basic that you're like, all right, Dave, thanks, Grandpa.
Yeah.
But you have to sit down and lay out the expectations, because the thing that you might think is a core assumption of like, well, surely Brad feels this way. I don't even need to express that.
Yeah.
The whole idea is that Brad could have an entirely different view on this, a totally orthogonal view from the way you have it. And so you need to have a conversation about, where do you stand on XYZ? What will we do if one of us gets sick? Or what will we do if one of us has a difference of opinion on how to code things? How will we work that out, right? You have to have those conversations about expectations. And then, Brad, I think the second one is that you when it comes time to get serious about it, you want to contractualize it, right?
Absolutely. And that contract is just a written down version of that conversation. Because all a contract is, at the end of the day, is codifying or putting into words your expectations. I expect this of you. You expect that of me. We expect this is how we're going to divide up the money. This is who owns what in terms of the licensing and the usage rights at the end of the product. That contract is just a way of putting those expectations into words so both people can read them clearly. I remember when I was teaching a sequential art class at Hushin School of Art, we were talking about contracts, and one of the students said, well, listen, I don't need a contract. I'm working with my cousin. We grew up together. You don't have contracts between family. And I said, oh, you're so wrong. Family and close friends are the first people that you need a contract with.
Yeah.
You need, I'm going to tell you, if you're working with your friend or you're working with your family, I want you twice as much to have a contract as I do two total strangers that are on the street.
In fact, in that conversation, as I said at the beginning, you want to have a conversation to start it off. In that early conversations, if the other party gets their hackles up because you have said you want to contractualize it, that's actually a tiny little red flag you don't want to do this, because you love them, you're great friends with them, you're family with them, whatever the situation is. If they get their hackles up on merely contractualizing it, that's a problem. That's they're being offended by something that should be basic business, which is, to Brad's point, a contract is basically saying, what are we going to do if everything falls apart? Here are the steps we're going to take if everything falls apart. What are we going to do if there's tremendous success and our return is 40 times profit of expenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third option is, what are we going to do if we muddle along? If everything's just going normal, how are we going to operate? And so a contract... granted, it's not going to foresee everything, but it will give you in broad strokes, what do you do if things fall apart? What do you do if things are a bang-up success? And what do you do if things are muddling along and slightly growing at a 2% growth every year, right?
Yeah.
And so if there's a family member that gets upset about that, or if there's a friend that gets upset about that, you have to ask yourself, well, what's going to happen when shit does hit the fan? Like right now, we're just having a conversation about contracts.
Yeah.
What are they going to do when you owe $10,000 or the deadline is next week and they can't do it or you can't do it?
Yeah.
So if they're reacting badly at the discussion of contractualization, they're not going to react well when you get to a really bad point in the process. Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah. And that's why I think you see very, very few creative teams in which both people are married to each other, right? And like a husband and wife creative team, because you've got to, once you start getting into those conflicts and it's in a relationship that you're in this intense romantic relationship, that stuff goes sour really, really quick, right? Dave and I can have a difference of opinion. We can yell at each other. We can scream, although I don't think we've ever yelled. But you know, we can have a real difference of opinion, separate for a couple of days, and then come back and readdress it with somebody who you are intimate with. That's a lot different. I think I'd be really scared of that.
In fact, I'm really glad that you brought up relationships, Brad, in terms of, like, say, romantic or married or whatever you have. Because a great pro tip that my wife actually came up with in the context of our relationship that I would actually like to share here is when you have a conversation with your partner on this project, your business partner, your art partner, it's good to delineate from what angle you are coming or from where the problem stands. So my wife, for example, if she says, hey, I want to talk to you, relationship problem, and then she goes, blah, 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 or I want to talk to you, roommate problem, those are very different things. Like, hey, you really got to help with the dishwasher versus I'm not feeling loved right now. You know, like that. Those are very different discussions. But so when you are in the midst of a creative project, like if Brad and I are having a creative project, we can say, hey, quick business topic. How much are we going to charge these people or how much are this or that? Bada bing, bada boom, right? That's a business topic. Versus if I say, hey, Brad, relationship issue, I feel like you're not calling me anymore or whatever it might be. You know, I'm trying to think of what might be a relationship issue.
Or you're not letting me talk to you yet, but you keep talking over me on the show, right? Like, Brad, you're not letting me get a word in edgewise on the show. You know, you got to settle down a little bit. That's more.
And by the way, I have a new headphone setting right now for this episode. So if I have been talking over you, which maybe that was a subtle way of telling me, no, I apologize to you. And I got to figure out a way to get this headphone to sit tighter on my head. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that I can keep the volume low so that it doesn't trigger the microphone and yet sit tighter on my head. So I'm going to Google that because I don't want to talk over my dear sweet Brad. My dear sweet Brad.
No, but that's that. The whole relationship versus roommate problem thing is a really good one to have moving forward, especially if you're in a creative situation with somebody that you're really, really close with, because those two tend to get confused and conflated an awful lot.
Absolutely. So anyway, not to belabor the point, but I just want to say that I want you to be careful when you're mixing friendships with business or family with business or friendship with art, because sometimes you can destroy both with nothing but good intentions going in.
Yeah.
So have a clear conversation up front, contractualize it when things start getting serious. Keep an eye out for red flags early on in the process when things are going great, because if there are red flags when things are going great, it's going to go real bad when things are going bad. So, and good luck with it, because when it works out, it's magic. I have loved doing this podcast with Brad. I absolutely love doing the film with Fred. I love doing How to Make Web Comics with Chris and Scott and Brad. There are projects where when you mix friendship and the project, it is so lovely. So I wish you the best of luck with it.
It can be magic. So, Dave, I've got another question from one of our Patreon backers, and this is a little offbeat one. I wanted to throw this one in here as a wild card because it doesn't have so much to do with comics, but it does have to do with kind of us as creative people in general. This comes in from Alexi, who says, do you as podcast hosts listen to other podcasts, either art or comic related or completely unrelated? What are they? And do you ever bring that influence into your work? Dave Kellett, I ask you, what podcasts are you listening to and why not?
I will say that I am not a big podcast listener, Brad.
Yeah.
I actually find most of them intolerable, which is probably terrible for me to say as a person that's actively recording a podcast right now.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy most of them in this sense. I would rather be with my own silence than to be listening to a podcast. And I think for a lot of people, they would rather listen to fill their time and listen to a podcast rather than be stuck with their own silence, you know? And so the only one that I listen to and I actually cherish is the Conan O'Brien podcast, which if you've never listened to that one, Brad, I highly recommend it. It's guest dependent. Some shows are spectacular depending on the guest, and some shows are just so-so. But I like the format. I love the interaction between the three of them. For me, it is I get a sense of why people like other podcasts, which is you get a window into their sense of friendship and growing camaraderie, you know, as you listen through to the show. So that's the only one. How about you? Do you listen to any podcasts and why or why not?
I don't listen to many podcasts at all. In fact, I'm very much just like you. I just listen to one I just have been listening to it for the past month. Like, I just started listening before last month. My answer would have been no. I don't listen to any podcast. And for me, you're all, oh, I like Serenity. I like Silence. I'm kind of the opposite. When I start listening to other podcasts, they drive me crazy because 9 chances out of 10, the people can't talk very well. They talk in a monotone. There's long pauses. They're not interesting. And I, because I kind of have a little bit of a passion for podcasting and a passion for talking, it drives me crazy. They don't change their voices. Make a point. You know, I cannot listen to a podcast for very long because I have really strong feelings about what a good podcast should be. And right. And as a result, I just get I get frustrated and have to turn it off. 9 chances out of 10, when I start listening to a podcast, I'm out within the first minute, like within the first 60 to 90 seconds. I've decided whether I love it or hate it. And 9 chances out of 10, it's hate it. And I hit the off button and I'm gone.
Yeah. The ones that I always try out whenever someone recommends is the other art podcasts and comic-specific podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be honest that usually within 60 to 90 seconds, I'm like, I can't take this. It's either like 1970s PBS where the voices are so slow and boring and just like somnolent and you just want to kind of curl up in a bed and because they're talking about art and isn't art precious? And it's just like, I'm going to fall asleep, you know?
It's the
and
kind
so
of
I
voice.
I can't stand that. That drives me nuts.
It's the kind of voice modulation that you would use if you were reading the instructions on how to defuse a bomb to somebody who really wanted to set that bomb off.
Right. And they happen to have had 20 espressos. So you're really trying to calm them down.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's also when the voice tone doesn't match the mood, like art is such a joy. It's the greatest joy of life, Brad, to create art. And I love it. I feel electric and on fire. It's almost orgasmic to have a kind of art creation.
Oh, my God. The absolute worst. Yeah. And I get, by the way, if you ever think about doing a podcast, especially in those opening days, think about that first 90 seconds, because I'm telling you, I think a lot of people make up their minds very early on. And I've heard so many podcasts. I heard one not too long ago where the co-host just spent like the first 2 minutes saying like stuff like, well, are we starting? Okay, we're going to start now. Okay, what are we going to talk about? And it's like, wait a minute, you jerks, edit. You know, you can edit this show. I don't need to hear all of this. Is this on? How you doing over there? What are we going to talk about? Well, we could talk about, holy cats, you know, do a little show prep to figure out what you're going to talk about and edit.
Well, now that we're sounding like grumpy old men on a porch again, let me ask you, do you like the murder podcast? You know, that's a big genre now of like,
no.
Oh, here's some people that got murdered. Let's figure out how they got murdered.
That's the first one I went to because I'm like everybody else. You watch these murder documentaries on Netflix and so you find out that there's a true crime type of deal. There was one that was ridiculously popular and I listened to it. And again, I was out within 90 seconds. I'll tell you what I discovered that I love and it's going to make you laugh. There's a podcast called My Dad Wrote a Porno.
Okay.
And it's about this guy. They're in Great Britain. And he discovers that his dad wrote a series of pornographic books. My dad wrote a porno. And this guy, by the way, I avoided, this show is like well into its fourth year. I avoided listening to it because it sounded like it was going to cut too close to home. Like, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't want my kids ever to be embarrassed that their dad wrote a porno. But this guy, hopefully unlike me, wrote the horriblest, just poorly written.
That's a thing of beauty. The idea that it was terrible.
It's funny in how poorly it's written. So basically what this guy did was got two of his friends in and kind of Mystery Science Theater 3000-ish that one person reads a chapter of the book while the other two people react in real time to what he's reading. And they are hysterical. It very much reminds me of like when we used to do, is it self-serving to say it reminds me of us? They're laughing their way through the entire show and cutting each other up and making fun of each other. It's a joy-filled show. And it's all from this guy's series of adult content books that were just written horribly from his inability to grasp the female anatomy and the names of the different operations
and parts.
Yeah. To just the fact that it's just wild, whacked out stuff. I mean, the plots are ridiculous. The action is ridiculous. Everything about it is ridiculous. Meanwhile, the guy, he goes by the moniker Rocky Flintstone.
Rocky Flintstone
is loving the fact that they've made a podcast about his books. He's enjoying a certain degree of internet fame. David, these guys have played like the Royal Albert Music Hall. They've played Rocket City. They played the big places. They played Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. So I will give this one a try. This sounds like it might be up my alley. I'll be honest, though, because what's going to happen after this podcast airs and you and I say that we don't really listen to podcasts and they're not really for us and we don't really enjoy them.
I know.
People are going to be like, well, Brad and Dave, you just haven't listened to the right ones. Here's a list of 10 that you should try. And I know what's going to happen. Yeah. I'm going to look at that list of 10 and say, oh, I've tried all 10. I hate all of those. It's going to be exactly what happened when we did the Slice of Life episode.
Yo.
And people are like, Dave Kellett, you just haven't read the right Slice of Life. What about so-and-so Slice of Life? And I'll be like, I read that and I do not like it. Yeah. It is not for me.
I suppose if Brad doesn't like Slice of Life, I suppose he doesn't like this very popular big name cartoonist. If you think you're going to get me to bad name or bad mouth another cartoonist in public, you're crazy. I'm not going to say anything about that. And by the way, chances are I probably don't.
Here's the great news, though. He will do it to me on the phone, and it has been delicious. Oh. It has been delicious to hear Brad's thoughts on some Slice of Life comics.
Oh, my God.
In general, though, I think there is a type of comic, to get back on that, that is a genre that is just, the best way to say it, as I teach my kids, it is not to my taste,
yes.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the comic is bad. It doesn't mean that it's bad for you. It is just not to my taste. And traditional Slice of Life, nothing happens. Here's a boring person going through their boring day. Oh. Not for me. It's just not for my taste. And that includes a lot of famous cartoonists that, yes, you could name right now that have all been in the Comics Journal. They always seem to end up in the Comics Journal. And it's not to my taste. God bless them. Oh. Not to my taste.
But yeah, so all of which to say, don't send us those lists. Don't send us the list of the podcasts we need to listen to, because chances are I'm right there with you, Dave. Chances are I've already tried it and I've already decided it's not to my taste.
Yeah, I've tried 10 or 15 of the murder podcasts. Oh. I've tried 10 to 15 of the story podcasts. I've tried the spoken word podcast or the improv podcast.
Yeah.
I've tried a lot. You know, we've all collectively had the better part of a decade to try out a lot of these. And for whatever reason, I just don't take a shine to it. But it is a fun question. And I'm glad you asked, because it's yet another opportunity for us to show what old grumpy men we are.
Yes, in case you had forgotten. Well, I do have to say this about podcasts. We're really glad that you're listening to ours. Having said all of that and alienated everybody, we're glad that you still listen to us. And we're glad that week after week, I can say you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my pal, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend, Dave Kellett, co-director of Strip, and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And honestly, do drop over to Apple Podcasts and put a quick 5-star rating and a few kind words on there. It is one of the ways where if you can't back the show on Patreon, we get it. This is a tricky year, a tricky period for all of us. Ooh. But those little recommendations do help over at Apple Podcasts. So make sure you go over and drop a quick 5-star review and a few kind words. It is very appreciated. And on that note, I will say Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that like the dean of the Harvard Law School, Skip Bipples. I didn't get picked.
I gotta listen to Suzanne Pleshette.
It's either like 1970s PBS let me start that over again. It's either like 1970s PBS voice. Oh my God, I did it again. Sorry, Matt.